He could meet with us at 3 o'clock once school was out, though it still meant I would miss practice and Maeve would have to take half a personal day from work. The three of us sat around a table in a small conference room, and there he told us that the one thing our father had put in place for us was an educational trust. "For both of us?" I asked. My sister was sitting in the chair beside me wearing the same navy dress she'd worn to the funeral. I was wearing a tie. "The trust is for you and for Andrea's daughters. Norma and Bright?" Maeve almost went across the table. "She gets everything and we have to pay for their education?" "You don't pay for anything. The trust pays for it." "But not for Maeve?" I asked. That was the travesty, the part he didn't bother to mention. "Since Maeve's already finished college, your father felt her education was complete," Lawyer Gooch said. Aside from that single lunch in the Italian restaurant in New York, our father had never talked to Maeve about her education, nor had he listened when she talked about it. He thought if she went to graduate school, she'd only get married halfway through and quit what she'd started. "The trust will pay for college?" Maeve asked. The way she said it made me realize it was one more thing she'd been worried about, how she was going to send me to college. "The trust pays for education," Lawyer Gooch said, enunciating the word education very clearly. Maeve leaned forward. "All education?" They may as well have been alone in their room. "All of it. For all three of them." "Yes, but Danny, of course, will go first, being the oldest. I think there's very little chance it's going to run out. Norma and Bernice should be able to get through school just fine." "Bright," I wanted to say and did not say. No one called her Bernice. "And what happens to the money that's left, if there's any left?" "Any money still in the trust when all three children have completed their education will be divided equally among the four of you." He might as well have said that half the money went back in Andrea's handbag. "And you administer the trust?" Maeve asked. "Andrea's lawyer set it up. She told your father she wanted to ensure the children's education, and from there," he tipped his head from side to side, "as long as we're in the lawyer's office, why not go ahead and put my name on everything you own?" Maeve was giving it her best guess. "More or less." "Then Danny needs to think about graduate school," Maeve said. Lawyer Gooch tapped his pen thoughtfully against a yellow legal pad. "That's a long way off, but yes, were Danny interested in graduate education, the cost would be covered. The trust stipulates that he maintain a minimum grade point average of 3.0 and that the education be contiguous. Your father felt strongly that school was not to be a vacation." My father never had to worry about Danny's grades. I would have liked to have said something for myself on this point, but I didn't think either of them would have listened. My father cared nothing about my grades, though maybe he would have if there had been a problem. He didn't care about my free throw as long as I sank it. What he cared about was how fast and straight I could hammer a nail and that I understood the timing involved in pouring cement. We cared about the same things. "Did you know I went to Choate?" the lawyer asked, as if his high school years were suddenly relevant to the conversation. Maeve sat with us for a minute and then told him no, she hadn't known that. Her voice was surprisingly soft, as if the thought of Lawyer Gooch being shipped off to boarding school made her sad. "Was it very expensive?"
"Almost as much as college." She nodded and looked at her hands.
"I could make some phone calls. They don't usually accept students in the middle of the year, but given the circumstances, I imagine they'd want to take a look at a basketball player with excellent grades." The two of them decided I would start Choate in January.
"Do you know what kind of kids go to boarding school?" I said to Maeve in the car after we left the office. My tone was full of accusation when, in fact, I'd never known anyone who'd gone to boarding school. I'd only known kids whose parents had threatened to send them after they'd been caught smoking weed or failing Algebra 2. When Andrea complained to my father that I didn't put my dirty clothes in the hamper, that I seemed to think Sandy was there to pick up my clothes off the floor and wash them and fold them and take them back to my room, he would say, "Well, I guess we're going to have to send him to boarding school then." That's what boarding school was, a threat or a joke about a threat. Maeve had other ideas.
Smart, rich kids go to boarding school, and then they go to Columbia. I slumped down in my seat and felt very sorry for myself. I didn't need to lose my school and my friends and my sister on top of everything else.
Why don't you cut to the chase and send me to an orphanage?
You don't qualify, she said. I don't have parents. It wasn't a topic we discussed. You have me, she said. Disqualified.
What are you doing now? Maeve asked.
I know I should know this, but I can never remember. I think they move you around too much.
Pulmonology.
The study of trains?
I smiled.
It was spring again. In fact, it was Easter, and I was back in Elkins Park for two whole nights. The cherry trees that lined the Books Bomb side of the street were pink and trembling, exhausted by the burden of so many petals. They turned the light pink and gold. This was a cherry tree's day, their very hour, and I, who never saw anything outside of the hospital, was there to witness it. The trains are almost finished. Orthopedics starts next week.
Strong as a mule and twice as smart.
Maeve dangled her arm out the window of her parked car, her fingers reenacting the memory of bygone cigarettes.
What? Haven't you heard that?
I guess it isn't a joke orthopedists make. Dad used to say it all the time.
Dad had something against orthopedists?
No, Dad had something against cauliflower. He hated orthopedists.
Why?
They put his knee on backwards. You remember that?
Someone put his knee on backwards?
I shook my head. That must have been before my time.
Maeve thought about it for a minute. I could see her scrolling through the years in her mind.
Maybe so. He meant it to be funny, but I have to say, when I was a kid, I thought it was true. His knee really did bend the wrong way. He used to go to orthopedists all the time, trying to get it to bend the other way, I guess. When I think of it now, it's kind of horrifying.
There would never be an end to all the things I'd wished I'd asked my father. After so many years, I thought less about his unwillingness to disclose and more about how stupid I'd been not to try harder.
Even if the surgeon put the knee on backwards, which, of course, isn't possible, we should probably be grateful he didn't amputate the leg. That happens all the time in war, you know. It takes a lot more time to save something than it does to cut it off.
Maeve made a face. It wasn't the Civil War, she said, as if amputation had been abandoned after Appomattox.
I don't think they even did surgery on his knee.
He said in France the doctors were in such a hurry they didn't always pay attention.
Things got turned around.
Really, it's kind of touching that he could even make a joke about it.
He must have had surgery when it happened. If you get shot in the knee, then somebody is going to have to operate.
Maeve looked at me like I had just opened the car door and taken the seat beside her, a complete stranger.
He wasn't shot.
Of course he was.
He broke his shoulder in a parachute jump, and he tore something in his knee, or he jammed the knee. He landed on his left leg, and then he fell over and broke his left shoulder.
There was the Dutch house right behind her, the backdrop to everything.
I wondered if we had grown up in the same house.
How have I always thought he was shot in the war? I have no idea. But he was in a hospital in France for his shoulder.
The problem was no one paid attention to his knee when it happened. I guess the shoulder really was a mess.
Then the knee hyperextended over time.
He wore a brace for years, and then the leg got stiff. They called it ortho... She stopped mid-syllable. Arthrofibrosis.
Exactly.
I remembered the braces being the source of the pain, heavy and ill-fitting. He complained about the brace, not the knee.
What about his shoulder?
She shrugged. I guess it turned out okay. I don't know. He never mentioned his shoulder.
All through medical school, and for at least a decade after, I had dreams in which I was in grand rounds presenting a patient I had never examined, which is how I felt that Easter morning. Cyril Conroy is an American paratrooper, 33 years of age. He was not shot.
I'll tell you something, Maeve said. When he had his heart attack, I always thought it was the stairs.
I couldn't imagine him trying to make it to the sixth floor of anything. He must have been mighty pissed off at someone to walk up a stairwell in that kind of heat to look at window ceiling.
As far as I know, he only went to the third floor of the Dutch house twice in his life. The day he brought Mommy and me to see the place for the first time, the day I came home for Thanksgiving and Andrea announced my exile. Remember that? He carried my bag upstairs. And then, when we got up there, he had to lie down on the bed. His leg was killing him. I put my suitcase under his foot to elevate it. I should have been screaming mad about Andrea, but all I could think was that I was never going to get him down the stairs again. We were going to have to live in the two little bedrooms off the ballroom, me and Dad. It's sort of a sweet thought, really. I wish we had. He said, "It's a nice-looking house, but it's too damn tall." I told him he should sell it then and buy a ranch house. I told him that would solve every problem he had, and we both laughed. "That really was something," she said, looking out the windows at the Books Bombs cherry trees. Getting Dad to laugh about anything in those days. There are a few times in life when you leap up and the past that you've been standing on falls away behind you, and the future you mean to land on is not yet in place, and for a moment you're suspended, knowing nothing and no one, not even yourself. It was an almost unbearably vivid present I found myself in that winter when Maeve drove me to Connecticut in the Oldsmobile. She kept meaning to get rid of it, but we had so little from the past. The sky was a piercing blue, and the sun doubled back on the snow and all but blinded us. In spite of everything we'd lost, we'd been happy together that fall we spent in her little apartment. Andrea had sold the company, lock, stock, and barrel. Every last building our father had owned was gone. I couldn't even imagine how much money it must have come to. I wanted to tell Maeve that wringing some spare change out of Norma and Bright's future, when I probably wasn't even capable of staying in school long enough to do that, wasn't reason enough for us to be separated. I'd go to college. Of course I'd go to college, but for now, I still wanted to play basketball with my friends and sit with her at the kitchen table over eggs and toast and talk about our days. But the world was in motion, and it felt like there was nothing we could do to stop it. Maeve had made up her mind that I was going to Choate. She had also made up her mind that I would go to medical school. When she added in a subspecialty, it was the longest and most expensive education she could piece together. "Does it even matter to you that I don't want to be a doctor?" I asked. "Does what I want to do with my life factor in this?" "Well, what do you want to do?" "I wanted to work with my father to buy and sell buildings. I wanted to build them from scratch, but that was gone. I don't know. Maybe I'll play basketball," I sounded petulant even to myself. Maeve would have loved to have had my problems to explore the limits of how extensively and expensively she could be educated. "Play all you want when you get off work at the hospital," she said, and followed the signs to Connecticut. Part 2. Chapter 8. The snow was coming down heavy and wet in New York on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Penn Station looked like a feed lot, and we, the anxious travelers, were the cows standing in pools of melting slush, bundled up and pressed together in the overheated terminal. We couldn't take off our coats and hats and scarves because our arms were full of suitcases and bags and books we didn't want to put on the disgusting floor. We stared at the departures board awaiting instruction. The sooner we could get to the train, the better our chances of claiming a seat that was forward-facing and not too close to the toilet. A kid with a backpack full of bricks kept turning to say something to his girlfriend, and every time he did, he clocked me with the full weight of his possessions. I wanted to be back in my dorm room at Columbia. I wanted to be on the train. I wanted to be out of my coat. I wanted to learn the layout of the periodic table. Maeve could have saved me from all of this had she troubled herself to come to New York now that she had overseen the delivery of who knew how many tons of frozen vegetables to grocery stores for the holiday. Otterson's was closed until Monday. My roommate was having Thanksgiving with his parents in Greenwich, so Maeve could have slept in his bed and we could have eaten Chinese and maybe seen a play. But Maeve would come to New York City only if circumstances demanded it, say when my appendix ruptured the first semester of my freshman year of college. I rode to Columbia Presbyterian with a hall proctor and an ambulance. When I woke up from surgery, Maeve was there asleep, her chair pulled next to the bed, her head on the mattress beside my arm. The dark mess of her hair spread out across me like a second blanket. I had no memory of calling her, but maybe someone else had. She was my emergency contact, after all, my next of kin. I was still floating in and out of the anesthesia, watching her dream, thinking, Maeve came to New York. Maeve hates coming to New York. It had something to do with how much she had loved Barnard and all the potential she had seen in herself then. New York represented her shame about things that were in no way her fault, or at least that's what I was thinking. I closed my eyes, and when I opened them again, she was sitting up in that same chair, holding my hand. There you are, she said, and smiled at me. How are you feeling? It would be years before I understood the very real danger of what had happened to me. At the time, I saw the surgery as something between a nuisance and an embarrassment. I started to make a joke, but she was looking at me with such tenderness, I stopped myself. I'm okay, I said. My mouth was sticky and dry. Listen, she said, her voice quiet. It's me first, then you. Do you understand? I gave her a loopy smile, but she shook her head. Me first. The spinners started clicking a jumble of letters and numbers, and when they stopped, the sign read, Harrisburg, 405, track 15, on time. Basketball had taught me how to move through a crowd. Most of the poor cows came to Penn Station just once a year and were easily confused, and the collective shuffling, very few turned in the right direction. By the time they'd puzzled out which way they were supposed to go, I was already on the train. On the plus side, the trip would give me more than an hour to study, time that was necessary to my continuing redemption in organic chemistry. My professor, the aptly named Dr. Abel, had called me to his office in early October to tell me I was on track to fail. It was 1968, and Columbia was burning. The students rioted, marched, occupied. We were a microcosm of a country at war, and every day we held up the mirror to show the country what we saw. The idea that anyone took note of a junior failing chemistry was preposterous, but there I was. I had already missed several classes, and he had a stack of my quizzes in front of him, so I don't suppose it took an act of clairvoyance to figure out I was in trouble. Dr. Abel's third-floor office was crammed with books and a smallish blackboard that featured an incomprehensible synthesis I was afraid he would ask me to explain. You're listed as pre-med, he began, looking at his notes. Is that right? I told him that was right. Still early in the semester, I'll get things back on track. He tapped his pencil on the pile of my disappointing work. They take chemistry seriously in medical school. If you don't pass, they don't let you in. That's why it's best we talk now. If we wait any longer, you won't catch up. I nodded, feeling an aching twist in my lower intestines. One of the reasons I'd always worked hard in school and gotten good grades was an effort to preclude this exact conversation. Dr. Abel said he'd been teaching chemistry long enough to have seen plenty of boys like me, that my problem wasn't a lack of ability, but the apparent failure to put in the necessary time. He was right, of course. I'd been distracted since the beginning of the semester. But he was also wrong, because I didn't think he'd seen plenty of boys like me. He was a thin man with a badly cut thatch of thick brown hair. I couldn't have guessed how old he was, only that in his tie and jacket, he resided in what I thought of as the other side. Chemistry is a beautiful system, Dr. Abel said. Every block builds on the previous block. If you don't understand Chapter 1, there's no point in going on to Chapter 2. Chapter 1 provides the keys to Chapter 2, and Chapters 1 and 2 together provide the keys to Chapter 3. We're on Chapter 4 now. It isn't possible to suddenly start working hard on Chapter 4 and catch up to the rest of the class. You have no keys. I said it had felt that way. Dr. Abel told me to go back to the beginning of the textbook and read the first chapter, answer every question at the end of that chapter, throw them out, wake up the next morning, and answer them again. Only when I had answered all of the questions correctly on both tries could I proceed to the next chapter. I wanted to ask him if he knew there were students sleeping on the floor of the president's office. What I said instead was, I still have to keep up in my other classes, making it sound like we were in negotiation for how much of my valuable time he was entitled to. The class had never been asked to answer all the chapter questions, much less to answer them twice. He gave me a long, flat look. Then this might not be your year for chemistry. I could not fail organic chemistry. Could not fail anything. My draft number was 17, and without academic deferment, I'd be sleeping in a ditch in Quezon. Still, what my sister would have done to me had I lost my academic standing would have far exceeded anything the government was capable of meting out. This wasn't a joke. This was falling asleep at the wheel while driving through a blizzard on the New Jersey Turnpike at midnight. Dr. Abel had shaken me just in time to see headlights barreling straight towards my windshield, and now I had a split second to jerk the car back into my own lane. The distance between me and annihilation was the width of a snowflake. I took an aisle seat on the train. There was nothing I needed to see between Manhattan and Philadelphia. Under normal circumstances, I would have put my bag on the seat beside me and tried to make myself look overlarge. But this was Thanksgiving week, and no one was getting away with two seats. Instead, I opened my textbook and hoped to project exactly what I was, a serious student of chemistry who could not be drawn into a conversation about the weather or Thanksgiving or the war. The Harrisburg contingent of the Penn Station Cows had been pressed through the turnstile and shaped in a single-file line that came down the platform and into the car, each of them whacking their bags into every seat they passed. I kept my eyes on my book until a woman tapped her freezing fingers against the side of my neck, not my shoulder like anyone would have done, my neck. "Young man," she said, and then looked down at the suitcase by her feet. She was somebody's grandmother who wondered how she had found herself in a world in which men allowed women to wrestle their own bags onto trains in the name of equality. The cows behind her kept pushing, unable to understand the temporary blockage. They were too afraid the train might leave without them. I got up and hoisted her luggage, a sad suitcase of brown plaid wool, cinched at the middle with a belt because the zipper could not be trusted, onto the overhead rack. With a single act of civility, I advertised my services as a porter, and women up and down the length of the car began to call. Several had Macy's and Wanamaker's bags full of wrapped Christmas presents in addition to their suitcases, and I wondered what it would be like to think so far in advance. Bag after bag, I worked to cram items onto the metal bars above the seats where they could not possibly fit. The universe might have been expanding, but the luggage rack was not. "Gentle," one woman said to me, raising her hands to pantomime how she would have done it were she a foot taller. When I finally looked in both directions and decided there was nothing more that could be done, I turned against the tide and pushed my way back to my seat. There I found a girl with loopy blonde curls sitting at the window, reading my chemistry book. "I saved your place," she said as the train lurched forward. I didn't know if she meant in the book or on the train, and I didn't ask because neither had required saving. I was on Chapter 9, chemistry having presented me with the keys at last. I sat down on my coat because I'd missed the chance to put it overhead. "I took chemistry in high school," the blonde said, turning the page. "Other girls took typing, but an A in chemistry is worth more than an A in typing." "Worth more how?" Chemistry had a better chance to serve the greater good, but certainly many more people would need to know how to type. "Your grade point average." Her face was a confluence of circles. Round eyes, rounded cheeks, round mouth, a small rounded nose. I had no intention of talking to her, but I also didn't know what choice I had as long as she was holding my book. When I asked her if she'd gotten an A in the class, she kept reading. She'd stumbled onto a point of interest, and in response to my question, gave an absent-minded nod. She found the chemistry more compelling than the fact that she had once gotten an A in chemistry, and that, I will admit, was winning. I waited all of 2 minutes before telling her I was going to need the book back. "Sure," she said, and handed it over, one finger marking the second section of Chapter 9. "It's funny to see it again, sort of like running into somebody you used to spend a lot of time with." "I spend a lot of time with chemistry." "It doesn't change," she said. I looked at the page while she rifled through her bag, pulling out a slim volume of poetry by Adrian Rich called Necessities of Life.
I wondered if she was reading it for a class or if she was just one of those girls who read poetry on trains. I didn't ask, and so we sat in companionable silence all the way to Newark. When the train stopped and the doors opened, she took a stick of juicy fruit from the pack in her pocket and stuck it into her book. Then she looked at me again with unbearable seriousness. "We should talk," she said. My girlfriend Susan had said we should talk at the end of our freshman year before telling me we were breaking up. "We should? Unless you want to take down the luggage for all the women getting off in Newark and then put up the luggage for all the women getting on." She was right, of course. There were women glowering in my direction and then looking pointedly up at their bags. There were other able-bodied men on the train, but they were used to me. "So you're going home," my seatmate said, leaning forward, smiling. She had put something on her lips to make them shiny. From a distance, a person would have thought we were engaged in meaningful conversation, or that we were engaged. I was close enough to smell the vestiges of her shampoo. "For Thanksgiving," I said. "Nice," she nodded slightly, holding my gaze in a lock so that I could plainly see the slight droop in her left eyelid, a defect that would have passed unnoticed had it not been for an episode of intense staring. "Harrisburg?" "Philadelphia," I said. And because we were for that moment very close, I added my suburb, Elkins Park. I forgot for a minute that I didn't live in Elkins Park anymore. I lived in Jenkintown, inasmuch as I lived anywhere. Maeve lived in Jenkintown. At the mention of Elkins Park, a light of familiarity sparked in her eyes. "Rydell." She touched the blue wool scarf that covered her sternum. Elkins Park was one town over from Rydell, which meant that we were practically neighbors. A woman leaned over us to say something, but my seatmate waved her away. "Buzzy Carter," I said, because his was the name to drop when speaking of Rydell. Buzzy and I had been in scouts together and later played on opposing church league basketball teams. He was born popular, and by the time we got to high school, he had good grades, good teeth, and a knack for racking up 40 points a game, not including assists. He was playing at Penn now, on a full ride. "He was a year ahead of me," she said, with a look on her face that girls got when thinking of Buzz. "He took my cousin to junior prom, though I never knew why." "You were at Cheltenham?" "Bishop McDevitt," I said, not wanting to get into anything complicated. "But the last 2 years, I went to boarding school." She smiled. "Your parents couldn't stand you?" I liked this girl. She had good timing. "Yeah," I said, "something like that." When the train left the station again, we resumed our commitment to be strangers, she with her poetry book, me with my chemistry. In our peaceful coexistence, we very nearly forgot about the other altogether. When the train pulled into 30th Street Station, the woman with the plaid suitcase, the one who'd started it all, shot straight to my side and dragged me down the aisle to get her bag. It was really stuck up there, jammed between all the other bags. Even if she'd stood on the armrest, she couldn't have reached it. Then another woman needed help, and another, and soon I started worrying that the doors were going to close and I'd have to ride the train to Paoli and double back. I saw the blonde head of my seatmate going towards the door. Maybe she'd waited as long as felt prudent, or maybe she hadn't waited at all. I told myself it didn't matter. I tugged down one last bag for a woman who seriously seemed to think I was supposed to carry it to the platform for her. Then I shook myself loose, grabbed my coat and suitcase, my textbook, and I slipped off the train just ahead of the closing doors. My sister was never hard to find. For one thing, I could pretty much count on her being taller than everyone else. And for another, she was always on time. If I was coming in on a train, Maeve would be front and center in the waiting crowd. She was there on this particular Wednesday before Thanksgiving, across the terminal, wearing jeans and a red wool sweater of mine I thought I'd lost. She waved to me, and I lifted my hand to wave back, but my seatmate grabbed my wrist. "Goodbye," she said, all blonde and smiling. "Good luck with the chemistry." She hoisted her bag up on her shoulder. I guess she'd put it down to wait for me. "Thanks." I had some strange inclination to hide her or to shoo her away, but there was my sister striding towards us. Maeve wrapped me in her arms, lifted me an inch or so off the ground, and shook me.
The first time she'd done that was the first Easter I'd come home from Choate, and she kept up the tradition just to prove she could. "Did you meet someone on the train?" Maeve said, looking at me instead of her. I turned to the girl. She was a perfectly average size, though everyone looked small when they stood between me and my sister. I remembered then that I hadn't asked her name. "Celeste," the girl said, and held out her hand, so we all shook hands. "Maeve," said Maeve. And I said, "Danny." And then we all wished one another happy Thanksgiving, said goodbye, and walked away. "You cut off your hair," I said once we were out of earshot. Maeve reached up and touched her neck just below the place where the dark hair ended in an abrupt bob. "Do you like it?" I thought it maybe looked more like an adult. I laughed. "I would have thought you'd be sick of always looking like an adult." She linked her arm through mine and dipped her head sideways to touch my shoulder. Her hair fell forward and covered her face for an instant, so she tossed her head back like a girl, I thought, and then remembered Maeve was a girl. "These will be the best 4 days of the year," she said, "the best 4 days until you come home for Christmas. Maybe for Christmas you'll come see me. I came to see you for Easter when you were in college." "I don't like the train," Maeve said, as if that were the end of that. "You could drive to Manhattan?" She stared at me to underscore the stupidity of the suggestion. "It's so much easier to take the train." "The train was a nightmare," I said. "Was the girl a nightmare?" "No, the girl was fine. She was a big help, actually. Did you like her?" We were nearly to the door that led out to the parking lot. Maeve had insisted on driving in to get me. "I liked her as well as you like the person you sit next to on the train. Where's she from?" "Why do you care where she's from?" "Because she's still standing there waiting, and no one's come to meet her. If you like her, then we could offer her a ride." I stopped and looked over my shoulder. She wasn't watching us. She was looking in the other direction. "Now you have eyes in the back of your head." I'd always thought it was possible. Celeste, who had seemed so competent on the train, looked decidedly lost in the station. She had saved me from a lot of luggage handling. "She's from Rydal. We could spare the extra 10 minutes to drive to Rydal." My sister was more aware of her surroundings than I was. She was also a nicer person. She waited with my bags and sent me back to ask Celeste if she needed a ride. After taking a few more minutes to scan the station for some member of her family, it had never been made clear which one of them was going to pick her up. She asked me again if she wasn't going to be a huge imposition. I said she was no trouble at all. The three of us walked to the parking lot together while Celeste continued to apologize. Then she crawled into the back of my sister's Volkswagen, and we drove her home. "You were the one who said we should give her a ride," Maeve said. "My memory on this is perfectly clear. We were going to the Gooch's for Thanksgiving, and I needed to get home and make the pie. Then you said you'd met this girl on the train and promised that I'd drive her home." "Utter bullshit. You never made a pie in your life." "I needed to go to the bakery and pick up the pie I'd ordered." I shook my head. "I always took the 405 train. The bakery would have been closed by the time I came in." "Would you stop? All I'm saying is I'm not responsible for Celeste." We were in her car, and we were laughing. The Volkswagen had been gone for years, replaced by a Volvo station wagon with seat heaters. That car chewed through snow. But on this particular day, it was only cold, not snowing. The lights in the Dutch house were already lit against the dark. This was part of a new tradition that came years later. After Celeste and I had dated and broken up and come back together again, after we had married, and after May and Kevin were born, after I had become a doctor and stopped being a doctor, after we had all tried for years to have Thanksgiving together in a civilized manner, and then had given up. Every year, Celeste and the kids and I drove to Rydal from the city on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. I left the three of them at her parents' house and went to have dinner with my sister. On Thanksgiving Day, Maeve served lunch to the homeless with a group from church, and I went back to eat with Celeste's enormous and ever-expanding family. Later in the evening, the kids and I would go back to see Maeve in Jenkintown. We'd bring refrigerator dishes heaped with leftovers, and slices of pie Celeste's mother had made. We ate the food cold while we played penny-ante poker at the dining room table. My daughter, whose dramatic nature was evident in earliest childhood, liked to say it was worse than having divorced parents. All the back and forth, I told her she had no idea what she was talking about. I wonder if Norma and Bright still come home for Thanksgiving, Maeve said. I wonder if they married people Andrea hates. Oh, they must have, I said. And for an instant, I could see how it all would have played out. I felt sorry for those men I would never meet. Pity the poor bastards brought to the Dutch house. Maeve shook her head. It's hard to imagine who would have been good enough for those girls. I gave my sister a pointed look, thinking she would get the joke, but she didn't. What? That's what Celeste always says about you, I said. What does Celeste always say about me? That you think no one would have been good enough for me. I've never said no one was good enough for you. I've said you could have found someone better than her. Ah, I said and held up my hand. Easy. My wife made disparaging remarks about my sister, and my sister made disparaging remarks about my wife, and I listened to both of them because it was impossible not to. For years, I worked to break them of their habits, to defend the honor of one to the other, and I had given up. Still, there were limits to how far they could go, and they both knew it. Maeve looked back out the window to the house. Celeste has beautiful children, Maeve said. Thank you. They look nothing like her. Oh, would that we had always lived in a world in which every man, woman, and child came equipped with a device for audio recording, still photography, and short films. I would have loved to have evidence more irrefutable than my own memory, since neither my sister nor my wife would back me on this. It was Maeve who had picked out Celeste. It was Maeve that Celeste first loved. I was there on that snowy car ride between 30th Street Station and Celeste's parents' house in Rydal in 1968. And Maeve was warm enough to clear the ice off the roads. Celeste was in the back seat, wedged between our suitcases, her knees pulled up because there was no room in the back of the little Beetle. Maeve's eyes kept drifting to the rearview mirror as she piled on the questions. Where was she in school? Celeste was a sophomore at Thomas More College. I tell myself, it's Fordham. That's where I would have gone. I wanted to study with the Jesuits. Where did you go to school? Celeste asked. Maeve sighed. Barnard, they came through with a scholarship, so that was that. As far as I knew, nothing in the story was true. Maeve certainly hadn't been a scholarship student. What are you studying? Maeve asked her. I'm an English major, Celeste said. I'm taking 20th century American poetry this semester. Poetry was my favorite class. Maeve's eyebrows raised in amazement. I don't keep up the way I should. That's the real drag about graduating. There's never as much time to read when there's no one there to make you do it. When did you ever take a poetry class? I asked my sister. Home is so sad, Maeve said. It stays as it was left, shaped to the comfort of the last to go, as if to win them back. Instead, bereft of anyone to please, it withers so, having no heart to put aside the theft. Once she was certain Maeve had stopped, Celeste picked up the line in a softer voice and turned again to what it started as, a joyous shot at how things ought to be. Long fallen wide. You can see how it was. Look at the pictures and the cutlery, the music and the piano stool, that vase. Larkin! The two cried out together. They could have been married on the spot, Maeve and Celeste. Such was their love at that moment. I looked at Maeve in astonishment. How did you know that? I didn't clear my curriculum with him, Maeve laughed, tilting her head in my direction, and so Celeste laughed too. What was your major? Celeste asked. When I turned around to look at her, she was utterly mysterious to me. They both were. Accounting, Maeve downshifted with a smack of her open palm as we gently slid down the snowy hill, over the river and through the woods. Very dull, very practical. I needed to make a living. Oh, sure, Celeste nodded. But Maeve hadn't majored in accounting. There was no such thing as an accounting major at Barnard. She'd majored in math, and she was first in her class. Accounting was what she did, not what she'd studied. Accounting was what she could do in her sleep. There's that cute little Episcopal church, Maeve slowed down on Homestead Road. I went to a wedding there once when I was growing up. The nuns about had a fit if they heard we even set foot in a Protestant church. Celeste nodded, having no idea she'd been asked a question. Thomas More was a Jesuit school, but that didn't necessarily mean the girl in the back of the car was a Catholic. We go to St. Hilary. She was Catholic. The house, when we pulled up in front of it, proved to be considerably less grand than the Dutch house and considerably grander than the third-floor walk-up where Maeve still lived in those days. Celeste's house was a respectable colonial clapboard painted yellow with white trim. Two leafless maples shivering in the front yard, one of them sporting a rope swing, the kind of house about which one could make careless assumptions about a happy childhood, though in Celeste's case, those assumptions proved true. You've been so nice, Celeste started, but Maeve cut her off. We'll take you in. But you don't. We've made it this far, Maeve said, putting the car in park. The least we can do is see you to the door. I had to get out anyway. I folded my seat forward and leaned back in to help Celeste out. Then I took her bag. Her father was still at his dental practice, filling cavities, staying late because the office would be closed on Thanksgiving and the day after. People came home for the holidays with toothaches they'd been putting off. Her two younger brothers were watching television with friends and shouted to Celeste, but didn't trouble themselves to leave the program. There was a much warmer greeting from a black lab named Lumpy. His name was Larry when he was a puppy, but he's gotten sort of lumpy, Celeste said. Celeste's mother was friendly and harried, cooking a sit-down dinner for 22 relatives who would descend the next day at noon. Small wonder she'd forgotten to pick up her third child at the train station. There were 5 Norcross children in total. After introductions had been made, Maeve got Celeste to write her phone number on a scrap of paper saying that she drove into the city every now and then, and could give her a ride, could even promise her the front seat next time. Celeste was grateful, and her mother was grateful, stirring a pot of cranberries on the stove. You two should stay for dinner. I owe you such a favor, Celeste's mother said to us, and then she realized her mistake. What am I saying? You're just home yourself. Columbia! Your parents must be dying to see you. Maeve thanked her for the invitation and accepted a small hug from Celeste, who shook my hand. My sister and I went down the snowy front walk. It seemed that every light in every house was on, up and down the block on both sides of the street. Everyone in Rydal had come home for Thanksgiving. Since when did you ever take a poetry class? I asked once we'd climbed back in the car. Since I saw her shove a book of poetry in her bag, Maeve cranked up the car's useless heater. So what? Maeve never tried to impress anyone, not even Lawyer Gooch, whom I believed she was secretly in love with. Why would you care if Celeste of Rydal thinks you read poetry? Because sooner or later, you'll find someone. And I'd rather you found a Catholic from Rydal than a Buddhist from, I don't know, Morocco. Are you serious? You're trying to find me a girlfriend? I'm trying to protect my own interests. That's all. Don't give it too much thought. I didn't. Chapter 9. If you lived in Jenkintown in 1968 or went to school at Choate, chances were good you'd cross paths with most of the people there eventually, even just to nod and say hello. But New York City was a wild card. Every hour was made up of a series of chances, and choosing to walk down one street instead of another had the potential to change everything, whom you met, what you saw or were spared from seeing. In the early days of our relationship, Celeste loved nothing better than to recount our origin story to friends, to strangers, and sometimes to me when we were alone. She'd meant to be on the 1:30 train from Penn Station that day, but her roommate wanted to take the subway together as far as Grand Central. The roommate then proceeded to dawdle with her packing for so long that Celeste missed the train. I could have gone on some other train, she said, putting her head on my chest. Or I could have taken the 405 and wound up in a different car. Or I could have been in the right car but picked another seat. We could have missed each other.
Maybe on that day, I would say, running the tips of my fingers along her fascinating curls.
But I would have found you eventually.
I said this because I knew it was what Celeste wanted to hear, this warm girl in my arms who smelled like ivory soap. But I believed it too, if not romantically, then at least statistically.
Two kids from Jenkintown and Rydell, going to college in New York City, were likely to bump into one another somewhere along the way.
The only reason I picked that seat was because I saw the chemistry book. You weren't even sitting there.
That's right, I said. Celeste smiled.
I always did like chemistry.
Celeste was plenty happy in those days, though in retrospect, she was the ultimate victim of bad timing, thinking that because she was good in chemistry, she should marry a doctor instead of becoming a doctor herself. Had she come along a few years later, she might have missed that trap altogether. The chemistry book was its own piece of chance. Had I paid attention from the beginning of the semester the way I should have, Dr. Abel would have had no reason to put the fear of God into me about failing, and I wouldn't have turned organic chemistry today into an extension of my arm. Who knew a chemistry book could act as bait for pretty girls? Had I not been close to failing, I wouldn't have been reading chemistry on the train. Had I not been reading chemistry on the train, I wouldn't have met Celeste. And my life as I have known it would never have been set in motion. But to tell the story only in terms of book and train, kinetics and girl, was to miss the reason I had very nearly failed chemistry to begin with. Maeve scotched any hopes I'd had of trying out for Columbia's basketball team. She said I'd be distracted from my classwork, wreck my GPA, and lose my chance to liquidate the trust before Norma and Bright could get to it. It wasn't much of a team, anyway. The upshot was I played ball whenever I could find a game, and on a sunny Saturday morning in the beginning of my junior year, I fell in with five guys from Columbia heading over to Mount Morris Park. I had the ball. As a group, we were skinny, long-haired, bearded, bespectacled, and in one case, barefoot. Ari, who left his dorm room without shoes, told us he had heard there was always guys looking for a game over at Mount Morris. His authority impressed us, though in retrospect, I'm pretty sure he had no idea what he was talking about. Harlem was a bloody mess, and while Mayor Lindsay was willing to walk the streets, Columbia students tended to stay on their own side of the gate. It had been different in 1959, when Maeve went to Barnard. Girls and their dates still got dressed up to go to the Apollo for amateur night. But by 1968, pretty much every representation of hope in the country had been put up against a wall and shot. Boys at Columbia went to class, and boys in Harlem went to war, a reality not suspended for a friendly Saturday pickup game. Walking to the park, the six of us began to get the message. We kept our eyes open, and so saw the open eyes of everyone we passed. The kids lying out across the stoops, and the men clustered on the corner, and the women leaning out of open windows, everyone watching. The women and girls walking by suggested that we should go home and fuck ourselves. The trash bags piled up along the curbs split open and spilled into the streets. A man in a white sleeveless undershirt with a pick the size of a dinner plate tucked into the back of his afro leaned into the open window of a car and turned the radio up. A brownstone with its windows boarded over and its front door missing had a notice pasted to the brick, "Tax foreclosure. For sale by public auction." I could see my father writing down the time and the date of the auction in the small spiral notebook he kept in his breast pocket. "You see a sign like that," he said to me once when I was a boy, and we were standing in front of an apartment building in North Philadelphia. "It might as well say, come and get it." I told him I didn't understand. The owners gave up. The bank gave up. The only people who haven't given up work for the Bureau of Internal Revenue because they never give up. All you have to do to own the building is pay the taxes. "Conroy," a kid from my chemistry class named Wallace called back to me. "Hustle up." They were already down the block, and now I was a white guy alone holding a basketball. "Conroy, move your ass," said one of the three boys sitting on the steps of the next building. Then another one yelled, "Conroy, make me a sandwich!" That was it, the moment of my spiritual awakening on 120th Street. I pointed to the building with the auction notice. "Who lives there?" I asked the kid, who thought I'd come to fix his lunch. "How the fuck do I know?" he said in 10-year-old parlance. "He's a cop," the second boy said. "Cops don't have balls," the third boy said. And this sent all three of them into rolling hysterics. My team had been waiting, and now, moving a little faster, they circled back. "Time to go, man." "Ari," he said. "He's a cop," the boy said again, then held out his finger like a gun. "All of you cops." I threw a chest pass to the kid in the red t-shirt, and he threw it straight back. 1-2. "Throw it here," the next one said. "Take these guys to the park," I said to the boys. "I'm going to be 1 minute." None of them seemed to think that this was a good idea, not my teammates and not the boys on the stoop, but I was already turning back to the liquor store on the corner to see if I could borrow a pen. Everything I needed to know could be written on the palm of my hand. On my way to look for a pickup game at Mount Morris, I became the sole beneficiary to an inheritance greater than my father's business or his house. My entire life snapped into sudden technicolor clarity. I needed a building, specifically the one on 120th near Lenox, in order to be who I was meant to be. I would put the windows in and replace the door myself. I would patch the drywall and sand the floors, and someday I would collect the rent on Saturdays. Maeve believed that medical school was my destiny, and Celeste believed that she was my destiny, and both of them were wrong. On Monday, I called Lawyer Gooch and explained my situation. My father had made provisions for my education, yes, but wouldn't it be so much more in keeping with his wishes to use that money instead to buy a building and launch myself in the career he'd intended me to have? Looking past the violence and filth, the pockets of impenetrable wealth, Manhattan was an island after all, and this part of the island was next to an ever-expanding university. Couldn't he petition the trust on my behalf? Lawyer Gooch listened patiently before explaining that wishes and logic were not applicable to trusts. My father had made arrangements for my education, not my career in real estate. 2 weeks later, I attended the public auction of the building that was meant to change my life. It sold for $1,800. I had no plans to recover. But, as usual, it turned out I was wrong. There were a lot of buildings in the neighborhood I now haunted, and it wasn't impossible to find another one that was burned out, full of squatters, and scheduled for auction. I spent so much time in Harlem, I felt suspicious even to myself. A white person was someone who either had something to buy or to sell, or he had plans to disrupt the commerce of others. I was included in this, even though I meant to buy something bigger than a bag of weed, and I meant to stay. While most Columbia students had never been to Harlem, I could have given tours. I did labor-intensive searches at the library and the records office to find the property taxes and price comps in a 10-block radius. I made appointments to see buildings that were for sale and tracked foreclosures in the paper. The only thing I neglected was chemistry, until I began to neglect Latin, physiology, and European history as well. My father had taught me how to check the joists beneath a porch for rot, how to talk an angry tenant down, and how to ground an outlet, but I had never seen him buy anything bigger than a sandwich. I realized I had two narratives for his life, the one in which he lived in Brooklyn and was poor, and the one in which he owned and ran a substantial construction and real estate company and was rich. What I lacked was the bridge. I didn't know how he'd gotten from one side to the other. "Real estate," Maeve said. I called her at home on a Saturday, a sack of quarters I should have been saving on the metal shelf in front of the dorm payphone. I know it was real estate, but what was the deal? What did he buy? Who would have given him a loan if he was really as poor as he always said he was? The line was quiet for a minute. "What are you doing?" "I'm trying to understand what happened in our life. I'm trying to do the thing you're always doing. I'm decoding the past." "On a Saturday morning?" she asked. "Long distance?" Maeve was exactly the person I should have talked to because she was my sister and because she had a knack for money. If anyone could have helped me solve the problem, it was her, but Maeve wasn't going to listen to anything that might sidetrack me from her dream of medical school. And even if I could have told her, what would I have said? I'd found another building in Harlem up for auction? A rooming house with a single bathroom on every floor? I'm just trying to figure out what happened, I said. And that much was true. I had spent countless hours in my father's company and never asked him a thing. The operator came on and said I needed to put in another 75 cents for the next 3 minutes, and when I declined to do so, the line went dead. Dr. Abel alone had seen me slip away, and it was Dr. Abel who called me into his office to bring me back to the righteous path of chemistry. He sent me to the department secretary to schedule appointments so that I could meet with him once a week during office hours. He said I had no absences left, and from then on would be expected to be present in class regardless of my health. While the rest of the students would be assigned 4 or 5 questions from the end of every chapter, I was to answer all of the questions and come in to have my answers checked. I was never sure if I'd been singled out for punishment or benevolence, but either way, I didn't think I deserved it. "Bring your parents by," he said to me a few days before Parents Weekend. "I'll tell them how well you're doing. Relieve their troubled minds." I was standing at the door of Dr. Abel's office and took an extra beat to decide whether to tell him the truth or just say thank you and leave it at that. I liked my persecutor, but my story was complicated and tended to engender a kind of sympathy in other people I'd never been able to tolerate. "What?" he said, waiting for my answer. "No parents?" He meant it as a joke, and so I laughed. "No parents," I said. "Well, I'll be in the office on Saturday as part of the festivities if you and your legal guardian want to come by." "We might do that," I said, and thanked him as I left. I put it together easily enough, and years later, Maurice Abel, whom everybody called Maury, confirmed my suspicion. He went to the registrar's office to look at my file. He never asked about my parents again, but he started to suggest we hold our weekly meetings over lunch at the Hungarian pastry shop. He invited me to the dinners he and his wife hosted for the graduate students in chemistry. He checked to see how I was doing in my other classes and alerted those teachers to my situation. Maury Abel took pity on me and became my advisor, thinking it had been my parentless state that had put me in academic peril, when in fact it was my father. Halfway through college, I had come to see I was a great deal like my father. Archimedes' principle states that any body completely or partially submerged in a fluid at rest is acted upon by an upward force, the magnitude of which is equal to the weight of the fluid displaced by the body. Or, to put it another way, you can hold a beach ball underwater, but the second you stop, it's going to shoot straight back up. And so, throughout my interminable academic career, I suppressed my nature. I did everything that was required of me while keeping a furtive list of the buildings I passed that were for sale, asking price, selling price, weeks on the market. I lurked at the periphery of foreclosure auctions, a habit I found hard to break. Like Celeste, I got an A in organic chemistry. Then I went on to biochemistry, second semester, and followed that with a year of physics with a lab, my senior year. Dr. Abel, who had met me when I was drowning, never took his eye off me again. With the exception of that one half semester, I was a good student. But even after I had recovered my standing, he always had it in his mind I could do better. He taught me how to learn and then relearn, to study until the answer to every question was coded in my fingerprints. I had told him I wanted to be a doctor, and he believed me. When the time came to apply, he not only wrote me a letter of recommendation, he walked my application 20 blocks uptown and handed it to the director of admissions at the medical school at Columbia himself. The fact that I had never wanted to be a doctor was nothing more than a footnote to a story that interested no one. You wouldn't think a person could succeed in something as difficult as medicine without wanting to do it, but it turned out I was part of a long and noble tradition of self-subjugation. I would guess at least half the students in my class would rather have been anywhere else. We were fulfilling the expectations that had been set for us. The sons of doctors were expected to become doctors so as to honor the tradition. The sons of immigrants were expected to become doctors in order to make a better life for their families. The sons who had been driven to work the hardest and be the smartest were expected to become doctors because back in the day, medicine was still where the smart kids went. Women had yet to be allowed to enroll at Columbia as undergraduates. But there were a handful of them in my medical school class. Who knows? Maybe they were the ones who actually wanted to be there. No one expected their daughters to become doctors in 1970. The daughters still had to fight for it. PNS, as the College of Physicians and Surgeons was known, had a thriving theater troupe made up of medical student actors. And to watch the shows the PNS Club put on, the dreary soon-to-be radiologists and urologists in half an inch of eyeliner bursting into gleeful song, was to see what they might have done with their lives had their lives belonged only to them. The first day of orientation took place in a lecture hall with stadium seating. Various faculty laid out impossible cases and told us that by the end of the year, we would be able, if not to solve those cases, then to at least discuss them knowledgeably. The head of cardiac surgery took the stage to extol the wonders of the cardiac surgery program, and the boys who had told their mothers they were going to be heart surgeons whistled and hollered and clapped, each one thinking that this was going to be him one day, the lord of it all. Then a neurologist came out, and other members of the audience cheered. One by one, every organ had its moment in the sun. Kidneys, lungs, oh, how they beamed. We were the smartest bunch of idiots around. When I was in medical school, I had a telephone in my apartment. We all did. Even in our first year, they wanted us to know we could be called to the hospital at any hour. My phone was ringing when I came to the door during my second week of school. "I have the most fantastic news," Maeve said. Long-distance rates were down at 6 o'clock, and then again at 10. The clock read 5 past 10. "All ears. I had lunch with Lawyer Gooch today. Strictly social. He thinks he's supposed to be my father. Now, halfway through the meal, he mentions that Andrea had contacted him." There was a time when this news might have perked me up, but I was too tired to care. If I started my homework immediately, I might be asleep by 2 in the morning. "And she called him to say she thought that sending you to medical school was excessive. She said she'd been given to believe that the trust was for college only."
"Who gave her to believe that?"
"No one. She's making it up. She said she hadn't complained about Choate because you just lost your father, but at this point she feels we're bilking the trust."
"We are bilking the trust." I sat down in the single kitchen chair and leaned against the little table. The phone was in the kitchen, what I called the kitchen closet. I tracked the path of a cockroach as it wandered down the front of the yellow metal cabinet and slipped beneath the door.
"He told me she looked up the cost of Columbia and that it was the single most expensive medical school in the country. Did you even know that? Number one. She said it's her proof that this is all a plot against her and that you could go to UPenn for half of what Columbia costs and leave some money for the girls. She told him simply she wasn't going to pay for Columbia anymore."
"Yeah, but she doesn't pay for it. The trust pays for it.
She perceives herself to be the trust."
I rubbed my eyes and nodded to no one.
"Well, what does Lawyer Gooch say? Does she have any case?" "None!" Maeve's gleeful voice was loud in my ear. "He said you can stay in school for the rest of your life."
"No, that's not going to happen."
"You never know. There are lots of fascinating things to pursue. You could live the life of the mind."
I thought of the endless maze that was the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. Our professors in their white coats sailing down the hallways like gods in their heaven. "I don't want to be a doctor. You know that, right?" Maeve didn't miss a beat.
"You don't have to be a doctor. You only have to study to be one. Once you're finished, you could play a doctor on television for all I care. You can be anything you want, as long as it requires a great deal of schooling."
"Go help the poor," I said. Maeve taught an evening class on how to make a budget through Catholic Charities, and on Tuesday nights, she stayed up late to grade their notebooks and correct their math. "I need to study."
"I wish you could be happy about this," she said. "But the truth is, it doesn't matter. I'm happy enough for both of us."
Happiness
had been suspended for the foreseeable future. I was taking human histology, embryology, and gross anatomy. The lessons of chemistry that Dr. Abel had drilled into me held fast. I answered every question at the end of every chapter, and in the morning I woke up and answered them again. We were put in groups of four, given a cadaver, a saw, and a scalpel, and told to go to work. The only other dead person I'd seen until that point was my father, and I found it far too easy to picture a group of white coats perched like vultures around his bed, waiting to open him up, disassemble, reassemble. Our cadaver was older than my father, a smaller brown-skinned man. His mouth was open in the same horrible way, as if it were the universal last act to try and fail to gasp a final breath. I would have thought that in order to cut a man apart and label him, I would have needed at the very least some degree of curiosity, but that wasn't the case. I did it because it was the assignment. Some of my classmates vomited in the lab that first day. Others made it to the hall or even the bathroom, but the carnage of our work didn't hit me until